The Spironians podcast is a Caruso's Archives production, supported by the Hedley Southeast Europe Cultural Heritage Fund. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the funding organization.
Welcome to another episode of The Spironians, the podcast that attempts to shed light on complex aspects of our society. I am Spyros Moraes, and today, we analyze a disturbing phenomenon that permeates historical and contemporary social strata, the culture of violence. From the most subtle kinds of verbal aggression to the most extreme manifestations of physical and psychological abuse, we will examine how violence is embedded in our beliefs, behaviors, and institutions. We will consider how certain patterns, stereotypes, and social institutions contribute the cycle's perpetuation, as well as how we may work as individuals and as a society to break it down. Our guest today is Antonia Sirigotti, a psychologist and co-founder of the European Network Against Violence. Antonia Sirigotti graduated from Pantheon University's Department of Psychology and received her master's degree in health promotion and education from the University of Athens Medical School. She has extensive experience in the prevention and treatment of domestic violence, gender-based violence against women and girls, and child abuse. She trains health and welfare professionals and leads awareness-raising programs for adolescents about healthy and unhealthy relationships. Antonia Sirigotti, welcome to the Spironians.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to meet with you and discuss the field I serve.
To begin the conversation, I'd like to highlight what author Marilyn French characterizes as patriarchy. This system prioritizes power over life, control over pleasure, and supremacy over happiness. What are the characteristics of a patriarchal society? And how do members of the ruling group benefit from such a system?
Most modern societies are patriarchal, which means that men dominate the major institutions, political parties and government, police, legal and judicial systems, corporations, businesses, education and health systems, and the media and entertainment industries. Members of this dominating group get enormous benefits, including higher salaries and overall increased reputation, authority, and control. This type of system employs violence and intimidation as monitoring tools in order to preserve power and control, as well as all of the benefits that come with being a member of the dominant group. Another one bites the dust.
I'm now thinking about the younger generations. Are young boys involved in the group that is taught that they will be granted privileges? Also, could you kindly explain how the presence of hierarchies among males affects the enjoyment of these advantages and benefits?
Boys are included in this group because, despite being told that they would receive rights when they grow up to be men, they are still inferior to men. The aforementioned hierarchy also applies to advantages and perks, which many men are deprived of for similar reasons. Despite these discrepancies, men continue to have greater advantages, privileges, and authority than women.
How does a sense of entitlement influence men's behavior towards women, perhaps leading to abusive behaviors like physical and sexual violence?
Men learn that certain privileges and benefits are theirs by right, and in the case of women, this frequently implies that women are expected to respect men and cater to their demands and desires. This feeling of, I have the right to, is also one of the reasons why men physically abuse their wives and partners, because they do not show the required respect or do not meet their needs and expectations, as well as sexually because they believe that women should satisfy the man's sexual desires. Another one bites the dust.
How does patriarchy produce hierarchies and their consequences for males, and what elements influence a man's position in these hierarchies?
Men face an onus in patriarchal societies as well, as there are similar hierarchies among men that are determined by social and economic status, religion, origin, educational level, sexual preferences, age, and other similar factors, and are maintained through the use of violence and intimidation. Few men ascend to the highest levels of the organization. Most people belong to both the dominant group and the oppressed group. For example, while a man has more authority than a woman, if he is poor, uneducated, homosexual, or a kid, his rank is lower than a rich, educated, or heterosexual guy.
What are the additional burdens of patriarchal systems for men and society in general? And what is the role of violence in maintaining these systems?
The added onus associated with patriarchal systems for men include the desire to defend their privileges and power, which frequently results in aggression or threats of violence, not only against women but also against men at lower levels of the social hierarchy. However, men face emotional and psychological consequences for the same reasons. Another significant cost for all of us is that patriarchal societies utilize violence to perpetuate inequities and injustice against the vast majority of citizens. To preserve a society's patriarchal structure, discrimination based on gender, origin, social class, economic level, religion, and sexual orientation is required. Another one bites the dust.
Let's speak about how art relates to violence. Taking Kazantzakis's literary work The Snake and the Lily as an example, we see a strong imposition of the main character's morbid feelings towards his beloved, who appears in the artwork solely as the object of his desire. Nikos Kazantzakis signed this amazing literary masterpiece under the pseudonym Karma Nirvami, the object of his affection. Whether it is the woman as a symbol, as in previous writings of modern Greek aestheticism, or whether he talks about his relation with Galatea or Kathleen Ford, has no place in the narrative. How does the romanticization of violence influence empathy?
The romanticization of violence has a profound impact on empathy and perceptions of the severity of violent acts in society. When violence is depicted as heroic, necessary, indispensable, or even romantic, it might impair people's ability to empathize with victims or comprehend the consequences of violent acts. That is, society perceives it as less likely to inflict trauma, pain, or significant repercussions. Instead of recognizing genuine violence and its victims, romanticization forces us to look at it through a lens that separates it from the repercussions. Empathy is the ability to comprehend and experience the emotions of others. However, romanticizing violence gives the erroneous notion that it might have a positive impact or be acceptable in some circumstances.
How can comfort in violence into a society shape people's perceptions of it and lead to the lack of empathy for victims?
People begin to perceive violence as natural or even necessary. This can make society less sympathetic to victims of violence, resulting in less empathy and encouragement for them. If we fail to recognize violence for what it is, an act that produces pain, fear, and trauma, we are more likely to underestimate its consequences and ignore the need for victim support.
So what needs to be done is to enhance society's empathy. How does fostering a culture that rejects violence in favor of peace and mutual understanding affect empathy and societal responses to violence?
Cultivating such a culture can increase empathy by helping people to understand victims of violence and recognize the extent of their actions. In this approach, the reason for violence is lessened, while positive social ideals such as peace and solidarity are reinforced. Also, let us not forget how we grew up. I once got asked if love hurts. We often hear that when parents strike their children, they did so for their own good or out of love. We often rationalize the violence: one didn't want it, one lost control, or one couldn't control it. Absolve the perpetrator: one was to blame, and blame the victim. Love should not hurt, and jealousy is not a proof of love, but rather of insecurity and an inability to build trusting and equitable relationships. As a result, romanticizing violence decreases empathy, while also undermining social knowledge of the significance of opposing violence and promoting peaceful coexistence and respect.
It is obvious, therefore, that the idealization or justification of violence, by whatever means, can impair our ability to empathize with victims and recognize the gravity of its repercussions.
Yes, absolutely, since instead of acknowledging the severity of the harm caused by violence, we might minimize or even rationalize it, viewing it as something essential or even justifiable. The portrayal of violence as romantic, revolutionary, or macho removes us from its true nature, making us less attentive to the needs of its victims. Another one bites the dust.
Thinking back to the previous episode of The Spironians, I recall what we were talking with Mr. Asterios Hagimikos about, Ometa. or metta, as an unwritten law of silence, internal societal pressure, and the need to protect honor and family standing all contribute to a violent culture. What particular steps may society, educational institutions, the media, and government regulations take to improve individual autonomy, promote diversity acceptance, and lessen internal societal pressure to adhere to stereotypes and established values?
From birth, each individual is constantly bombarded with explicit and implicit messages from their family, school, and the community in which they reside that establish the appropriate standard of femininity and masculinity. These messages pressure people to conform to a wide range of duties and expectations based on their socially determined gender. In patriarchal societies, individuals of different genders are expected to adopt distinct ideals. Under these conditions, boys and girls, women and men, trapped in the prison of their gender stereotypes, are persuaded to accept and fulfill diametrically opposed roles. The boy man must always be victorious, in control, and strong, aggressive, and competitive, whereas the girl woman must be sensitive and emotional, tolerant, passive, and selfless.
What is the link between established conceptions of one gender's control over the other and the prevalence of violence in relationships? And what paradoxes emerge from our social attitude towards these stereotypes and violence?
With such firmly rooted attitudes that place one gender above the other, it is not unexpected that violence occurs in relationships. The paradox is obvious. We all, consciously or unconsciously, perpetuate societal preconceptions that lead to violence while striving to eradicate violence in our community while not recognizing the link between gender stereotypes and violence against women and girls. This is precisely why prevention must begin at the earliest possible age, and the system of all educational levels provides the ideal foundation. For such an effort to be gradually established, beginning in kindergarten and finishing at university, or even continuing throughout lifelong learning.
I believe that prevention is the most crucial factor in bringing about a shift in society's mindset. Please tell us about the measures of prevention.
To address violence and promote acceptance, measures must be implemented in education, dialogue, diversity, healthy relationships, the media positive role models, avoiding idealization, social policies support, victim safety, discouraging violence, the community, cooperation, understanding, and psychological support, victim empowerment. The combined adoption of these initiatives can result in healthier and more varied societies. Also, as a country, we must execute the provisions of the Istanbul Convention, which is a comprehensive plan that focuses on primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. The Istanbul Convention, also known as the Convention on Preventing and Combating Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence, is built around three fundamental pillars, known as the four Ps.
What do the four Ps refer to?
Prevention through educational initiatives and awareness raising, protection through safe havens and legal and psychological support, and criminalization through the formation of a legislative framework and competent law enforcement. Cooperation between governments and non-governmental organizations is also encouraged, as is more social participation. Coordinated work in these areas is critical for creating a safer and more equitable social environment. Another one bites the dust.
Our country signed this convention, right?
Unfortunately, despite signing and ratifying the convention, Greece is not fully implementing it in practice. According to Grevio's first evaluation report, 71 recommendations and proposals were developed, which were rated based on their level of urgency. Specifically, 25.3% of the recommendations are deemed urgent due to inconsistencies with national legislation or non-implementation of the convention's provisions, while 47.9% are deemed urgent due to discovered flaws that must be corrected immediately. In addition, 18 proposals, 25.3%, are deemed essential but not urgent, with Grevio asking Greece to address them at a later time. This report emphasizes the importance of taking quick and substantial steps to fully comply with the convention's requirements.
After you've given us these key aspects and important information, let us return to Nikos Kazantzakis's work, The Serpent and the Lily. The critical approach towards Kazantzakis's literature may be termed censorship, which has no place in a democratic society. Nonetheless, there are novel techniques of accepting or rejecting perceptions. If the author were living now and shared his artwork on social media, would he be a target of mass attacks such as cancel culture or a pop culture influencer who positively influences the romanticization of violence?
If Kazantzakis were living now and sharing this literary work on social media, he might find himself in a highly polarized social situation. On the one hand, his art, with its strong philosophical dimension, romanticization of imposition and questioning of traditional morality, may appeal to individuals who value social and cultural norm subversion, potentially elevating him to the status of pop culture influencer. These people may regard him as a figure of independent thought, inquiry, and defiance of social preconceptions, possibly linking him with ideals that encourage individual liberty and revolution. On the other hand, his work could become the object of widespread criticism via cancel culture. In today's world, where political correctness and social sensitivity are more acute than ever, Kazantzakis' references to romantic obsession and extreme ambivalence may elicit reactions, particularly among audiences that value social justice and inclusivity. Those who oppose the hero's version of imposition may reject his image as a role model who supports personal resistance. Finally, how current society responds to Kazantzakis' work will be determined by each group's perspectives and social sensitivities. He may be a divisive figure, balancing the defense of free speech and critique of social structures with opposition and condemnation from those who believe his messages promote dangerous views.
It would be interesting to see how such a post would go down on social media. Right? So, at this point, I'd want to thank you for our conversation and the valuable information you shared with us.
Thank you too for the invitation.
Thank you all for listening. We will reach you shortly with a new and interesting episode. In closing, I'd want to reiterate what our guest mentioned earlier. Love should not hurt.
Another one busts the dust. Ow! Another one busts the dust. Hey, hey! Another one busts.